So we have been working our way through the Gospel of John, and we are in chapter 16, looking at verses 16 through 24. And we have noted throughout the Upper Room Discourse that Jesus was encouraging and preparing his disciples because of what was coming, what was going to happen to him, and what was going to take place for them, so that they would be equipped to be able to deal with these things. Jesus knew how difficult it was going to be for them because he knew what was coming, and so he was wanting to prepare them. That's why the Upper Room Discourse in and of itself is so significant and takes up a great amount of space in the Gospel of John, because there's so much there, and it is also, I think, helpful for us to keep in mind that it relates to us as well, because the Lord was preparing his disciples for what was to come, and what was to come was going to include the inception of the church in just a matter of days from this time. Some of the details that are going to be dealt with in this section have been repeated before several times, and so it's communicating that something important is taking place, something outside of the normal state of things, and so it's being repeated for emphasis. Now, we have a system at our house where when there is an event that's going to be taking place, and there is a need for a reminder to remind one or the other of us, to remind the other one to be remembering what needs to be taking place. I suspect some of you can relate to that. Don't forget to remind me that I have to do this, that, or the other thing. So you can relate. Well, that's what Jesus was doing. He was reminding his disciples multiple times that this is going to be taking place. You need to be prepared for it. So our text today also repeats some things. It is all with the intent of encouraging the disciples in his absence, which was going to be very soon to take place. The anticipation of what was coming included various predictive elements, some things in the very near future, some things in the not quite as near future, and some things that had implications far beyond all of that. But in all of this, there are lessons for us because it has to do with the inception of the church that is going to be taking place as a result of what is happening here, part of which we've already heard referenced regarding the presence and coming of the Spirit, who is going to be instrumental in the inception of the church, as is noted in the book of Acts. So, with that in mind, we want to consider the first section here, a misunderstood prediction about timing and presence. Verses 16 and 17 say, "A little while, and you will not see me, and again a little while, and you will see me, because I go to the Father." Then some of his disciples said among themselves, "What is this that he says to us, 'A little while and you will not see me, and a little while and you will see me, and because I go to the Father'?" I appreciate those times when the disciples asked questions and got some clarification, because it's usually helpful for us as well. Then continuing verses 18 and 19, "They said therefore, 'What is this that he says, a little while? We do not know what he is saying.' Now Jesus knew that they desired to ask him, and he said to them, 'Are you inquiring among yourselves about what I said, a little while and you will not see me, and again a little while and you will see me?'" So kind of an extended reference here to this matter of trying to understand this. The intention of the prediction was to provide encouragement. Jesus wanted his disciples to know they would see him again, because what was going to be taking place was going to be rather traumatic, to put it mildly. And so he was wanting to provide some encouragement so that they would know that he would be seeing them again. He knew both his plans, what he was going to be doing, and he knew their concerns, what they were going to be experiencing. That ought to be some encouragement for us when we go through things. The Lord knows what's going on in our own hearts. And I can't help but think he knows what's going on in Israel right now, in the lives of those people who are experiencing some great devastation, particularly those that are closer to the particular areas of conflict right now. So he also expressed his repeated concern for his disciples. He wanted them to be informed of what to expect. Now, we like that as well. When we go to see a physician, we want to know, what is this and what's going to happen? What can I do about it? How can I get rid of it? I want to know what the future holds. It's kind of helpful. And sometimes we get a good answer. And sometimes the answer is, well, I'm not sure. Give us some time. Let's do some tests. And then you have to wait a little longer. And that's why we are called patients. You already knew that. But that's how that works. But he wanted them to be prepared for what was coming. And he wanted them to know that he knew what was coming. Because they'd already come to realize that he kind of wasn't like everybody else. There was something about him, and he tended to know things and could do things that other people couldn't do, which is what they needed to recognize, and because that was going to be significant for what was yet to take place. So he wanted them to know what is about to happen was anticipated and was planned and was no surprise to him. But as we know, they still didn't get it. Even after he told them and warned them repeatedly, they still didn't get it. And we might have been in that same boat. You recall the occasion in Luke chapter 24, verses 25 to 27, where Jesus is talking to the disciples on the road to Emmaus. And he said to them, "O foolish ones and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken, ought not the Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into his glory?" And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, he expounded to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And we could say, well, why didn't he do that before? Well, he tried, kind of. I mean, he told them what was going to happen. And today there are still many who are slow of heart to believe. And some of us who do believe are still a little slow at picking up on a few of the details here and there. That's why we need to continue our study and analysis of Scripture. But for these individuals, they were able to then look back and realize that he knew what was coming. And this confirmed his authority, his validity, and should have also given some encouragement to them to say, well, the things that have happened just like he said. Therefore, the things that have yet to happen are going to happen just as he said as well. Oh, I forgot that I didn't show you that. The result of the prediction was to cause confusion. The disciples were musing among themselves the meaning of a little while, the timing. They were trying to sort that out. The first little while was just a few hours. The second little while was just a few days. And the disciples didn't recognize the significance of that yet. But it should have helped prepare them for what was to come so that when it did happen, they could understand it and it would make sense. And so the intent was that his departure would not seem as traumatic. Because we do know from reading scriptures, when they saw him arrested, mistreated, crucified, and dead on the cross, they thought it was all over. But they had been told that it's not all over. He's going to come back. But they didn't see that because they didn't have a category in their thinking that had to do with someone coming back to life from the dead. I mean, they had seen some examples of people who were raised, so they should have probably, but that's not normal. That's not part of their thinking. They just didn't have that in their thing, because they had seen on a few occasions where Jesus had raised someone from the dead. But if Jesus is gone, who's going to raise him from the dead? That's a problem. But they should have recognized he came from the Father. The Father is kind of watching out for things here. But they had a lot to process. So it's not surprising that they failed to understand so much of what was happening, even though Jesus tried to prepare them multiple times. The response of Jesus indicated his knowledge and their faulty inquiry. What were they looking back to in their thinking, in their responses? So Jesus knew that the disciples were discussing this among themselves. The question that might come to our minds is, why didn't they just ask him? Instead of going, what was he talking about? Anybody know? He knew they were confused. And he knew that this was going to be stretching their understanding. And he knew that he needed to be patient with them. And I think we have to appreciate that he is patient with our lack of understanding as well. Have you thought about how many things you have wrestled with over your lifetime of a theological nature that you've tried to figure out and it didn't happen immediately? It's like, I need a little more time to sort this out and think this through. So we can appreciate his patience with us and be thankful for that as well. A needed prediction about joy and sorrow. Here, looking at verses 20 and 21 and 20 to 22. Most assuredly, I say to you that you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice, and you will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will be turned into joy. Another prediction of joy coming after the sorrow. A woman, when she is in labor, has sorrow because her hour has come, but as soon as she has given birth to the child, she no longer remembers the anguish. I suspect there's a few of you who might say, wait a minute, I remember. For joy that a human being has been born into the world, but there's something that overshadows that. Therefore, you now have sorrow, but I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no one will take from you. Again, you can see there's the anticipation that hard times are coming, but good is going to ultimately come from that. There will be joy. So the anticipated sorrow would be replaced with joy. There is a clear anticipation of sorrow. Jesus is indicating he knew very well that this was going to be hard for them. There was sorrow at the thought of his leaving them. They were already feeling sad just thinking about it, even though they didn't know all the details. They didn't know the implications of it. There would be more sorrow at the reality of his departure. It's going to get even worse. And they would feel much more sadness at the circumstances of his leaving. He wasn't just leaving on vacation. He was leaving this life for a time, because they would have to face the significance of his arrest, trials, torture, death, and all of that would be very traumatic in many ways. There would be rejoicing over his death by the world. And this has the idea of the world, those who are not trusting in him, not believing in him. In this case, it would be the unbelieving Jewish people, particularly, that were rejecting him. They would be rejoicing that this troublemaker is eliminated. They got rid of the problem. Interesting to think about. Their problems were just beginning. But he provided the solution to the problems. Their calls for his death would be realized. They even welcomed blame on themselves for his death. And it does remind us that the world system was behind his death. That is Satan's plan. And it's most obvious as we see the references to Judas's participation in it and Satan's part in that. But their sorrow would turn to joy at Christ's return to them. And this historical record indicates that this was so. The circumstances would be radically reversed, and ultimate victory would arise from this apparent defeat. And the joy would return after the resurrection. After a little bit of time for them to catch on that this is for real, because it didn't seem like it. It seemed too fanciful. Like, how can this be? And the joy of his return even managed to overshadow their guilt for abandoning him at his arrest. And we know that in Peter's case in particular, there was a bit to work through on his part. The prediction of joy was to provide encouragement. The anticipation of joy can help one handle the hard times. That brings to mind an occasion in my educational experience when I was at Dallas Seminary, and I was taking second year Hebrew with Dr. Alan Ross in the summer, in like 8 weeks or something. And it was like a fire hose kind of coming at you. And what kept me going was knowing after that I would have 2 weeks off vacation. We were going back to Michigan to visit family and go up to the Upper Peninsula and do some camping before the next semester started. So it's like, I can keep on going. I can make it. I can keep pressing on. If I know that something like that is an opportunity yet. So that makes a difference. And that's kind of part of our common experience. We see that. There is hope when after we've endured something very difficult, the hardship. I mean, we can go through some difficult medical procedures if we know that there's benefit that's going to come from it. So we can appreciate that as well. It reminds me of when I was, again, in seminary. It was in the middle of that year, I think it was, when I had a herniated disc in my neck and ended up having to have surgery. And I had a little over a month of going through all kinds of analysis and all of this stuff during the basically from about Thanksgiving to Christmas. It was just miserable because I remember trying to study at night in the evening, and I would study for a while, and it's like the pain is just too bad. I'd go lay down for a little bit, and then I'd go, I've got to get some work done, get back up. And then it kind of went on all night like that for many weeks. And finally, when I had the surgery, and I was in the hospital for a week, during exam week, mind you, and when I woke up from the surgery, the first thing I realized was the pain was gone. Because sometimes when you have surgery, the pain is worse. In this case, the pain was like gone because it was, you know, a pinched nerve. And it was just amazing. And I actually watched part of a Cowboys football game after that. I figured Mike would appreciate that. Well, we were living in Dallas, you had to watch the Cowboys. That was just kind of part of the rules. But anyway, you can relate to that matter. that joy that brings encouragement if you're anticipating it and experiencing it. So then there's the childbirth analogy that illustrates the element of intensity. I have no personal experience on that, so I won't tell you a story of mine. But the intensity of pain can be endured for a good purpose. And the intensity of joy is heightened by the experience of pain or greater exertion. Now, I can relate at least in one instance of something that I can relate to on that, because I've done the bicycling ride up the mountain numerous times. And there's an element of exertion on the way up, but there's an element of exhilaration on the way down. So there was one occasion when I cheated with some family members who wanted to ride down, who did not want to ride up, and I rode with them in a car with having some help driving up. And so then I rode down with them, and I felt like it was cheating because I didn't do the ride up. But they weren't prepared to do the ride up at that point. But the pain is worth the gain. You may have heard that. And for Jesus and his disciples, the pain that they were going to go through was worth the gain as well. And it's a good reminder that the pains of this life will be worth the joys and the blessedness of the life to come. And that's the one thing I think we need to come back to, is that hope of the future is a great motivator for us when we're going through the hard times. And I was reminded of that with the recent passing of my parents over this summer. In both cases, their physical decline was significant, and the anticipation of future glory was great before them. And we were encouraged in that very much. A repeated prediction about asking and receiving. And this, again, is familiar. And in that day you will ask me nothing. Most assuredly, I say to you, whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. It's interesting. He's saying, you will ask me nothing, but you will ask the Father in my name. He will give you. Until now, you have asked nothing in my name. Ask and you will receive, that your joy may be full. Again, a familiar passage for us. There will be a means of making future requests. The context indicates the day in view, that day. It is a time when Jesus has departed and the Holy Spirit had come. And this would be after Jesus' resurrection and his ascension, when he is departed from them, so that they can't ask him. But he is telling them, you will be able to ask the Father in my name. The disciples would ask him no questions due to absence, because he wasn't bodily present. But they would have access to the Father through Christ, praying in his name. Acts 1:14 says, and these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. So they were recognizing that opportunity. There will be a necessary protocol for requests. Jesus encouraged his disciples to freely ask of the Father. And this was a repeated promise, because we've seen this, of this provision. John 14:13-14 says, and whatever you ask in my name, that I will do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it. John 15:16, you did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, that your fruit should remain, and whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. And there's a sense in which he is vicariously doing this as well. So this was an encouragement of ongoing provision, even though he is not there presently, physically with them. The provision is there, and that provision continues today. But there's a specific parameter of requesting, and that is in Jesus' name. We've spent some time talking about that. It's a matter of being consistent with his will and his character. It's not just a formula. It's a mindset of recognizing it's because of Christ, and it's in his name. It's consistent with him and his character. This appeal to the Father in Jesus' name is a new concept not just in the Gospel of John here because he brought it up before, but it's a new concept in relation to the Old Testament times. Old Testament believers grounded their petitions in God's Old Testament promises. And this special access that Jesus now provided to them, to the Father, would assure them of an even warmer response to their prayers than the Old Testament saints received. It's a closer relationship because they're dealing directly through Christ. The second mention of asking here is a command. The verb in the Greek text is a present imperative. According to one Greek grammar, the imperative mood is used, quote, where the mind purposes the realization of a possible action through the exercise of the will upon an intermediate agent and conditioned upon the agent's response being volitionally possible. So it's assuming that there's potential there. So it indicates the relation to reality as potential, an ability of the agent to perform the action, an expectation on the part of the one making the imperative statement. So Christ is saying, you will be able to do this, so take advantage of it. It indicates that an action that is possible and it's expected to be done. And he also gave them assurance that they would receive what they requested when it was in his name. That means consistent with his will. The consequence of answered prayer would be fullness of joy. Again, this joy idea is coming out again. So even though Jesus was going to be absent from them, he would provide sufficient care for them by the Spirit's presence and by direct access to the Father through his name. So all of this was to tell them, you don't have to fear, though there are things that are going to be happening that are going to be difficult. And we can be reminded of the provisions that we can enjoy to the same degree that they did. And we can ask ourselves, are we taking advantage of these gracious provisions? It's also interesting to see how the three persons of the Godhead are actively involved in this process. We have the Spirit's presence. We have access through the Son to the Father. All of that is part of the picture. So we have reason to be encouraged in the living of our lives, in the present as well as in the future, for what we have to anticipate. So there's some perspective here. And what he's trying to tell his disciples, that even though he's not going to be present with them, he is providing for them, and they are not alone. They are not left as orphans, and so they can trust him, and we can do the same.